Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for February 13th, 2011, a day before Valentine's. And we even have a segment that Catherine thought of themed around Valentine's Day. But first, let me welcome everybody in from Chattooga County. Welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, and from Atlanta, Catherine Smith. Welcome.
Hello, and welcome. Everyone who's listening.
Yes, and about 2 weeks ago I had alluded to there would be some changes coming up on the Kudzu Vine. More things are happening, but one thing that I did want to share with everybody is we're now on the upgraded plan for Blog Talk Radio. And one thing people have always wanted to know, if they could just call in and listen like they weren't in front of a computer, and would it be okay? Previously we had like five lines, and so when with us having guests and, you know, our host lines and all that, we kind of were limited, and we kind of frowned on that. Now we have apparently 50 lines. Don't think we'll ever have 50 guests, because obviously there's just not enough microphone to go around. So if you ever are on the road, want to listen, you feel free to call in 646-478-4503. Listen in. Now, we may try to bring you in to talk, because, you know, we love callers to talk. So, of course, if you want to talk tonight, do that. And here in about 15 minutes, we've got an exciting guest from South Carolina. Jennifer Reed of the Indigo Journal, one of our favorite guests and probably the expert that we know of on South Carolina politics, will be joining us. And we have a lot more, but since it's the 13th and Catherine has such a good idea, we're going to lead off with this. Catherine, explain your concept.
Well, I just thought we should all, you know, pick a Valentine for the, you know, a political Valentine for the for Valentine's Day. I know, David, you didn't have a chance to do it, but I know Tim did. Tim, you want to go first?
Sure, be glad to, Catherine. My Valentine is a state representative from Tennessee by the name of Julia Hurley. Now, she's Republican, conservative, NRA member, social conservative, blah, blah, blah. In other words, everything that I don't personally care for in politics, in other words. So why is this 29-year-old my Valentine? And I have an answer for you. And I have a drum roll. She used to be a Hooters girl. Now look, I know what you're all thinking out there, but I promise I only go to Hooters for the excellent chicken wings, okay? That's my Valentine, Catherine.
Well, my Valentine is a little bit more routine, I guess, not quite as provocative, but I've always been a fan of Kasim Reed's. When he was in the state Senate, I had a lot of admiration for him, and I think he's been doing a wonderful job as mayor. And this morning on Meet the Press, he did a great job of representing Atlanta and talking about the tough problems and financial woes that so many cities are facing and how important it is for some of the larger cities to make the first step in economic recovery. And he was very articulate and very good, and I was really proud that he was my mayor. So I hope that Kasim Reed is my Valentine this year.
Yeah, well, that's good that y'all came up with this concept. By the way, Tim, I'll be honest. I was picturing Hooters girl, and I went ahead and Googled the picture. You sure she didn't cook there instead of waitress? I see the picture. She's got some kind of gloves on.
She just did it all. I've seen another picture with her in, shall we say, the more traditional uniform, and I'll just let it go there, okay?
This is a People magazine, man. People's got to do better than this. Isn't this the people that compile the most beautiful list or whatever? I mean, come on, People, you can do better. And speaking of your Valentine, Catherine, Kasim Reed was on Meet the Press today, so that seems like a good segue into that. I heard the reviews were very solid. Did either of y'all have a chance to watch it?
I did see it. It was very good. He was very good. he talked about, you know, the problems facing Atlanta and how he's overcome some of them and how he's working really hard, facing all the economic problems that cities, that Atlanta and cities like them are facing. And he talked about how cities, because they're not as large, the, you know, budgets and economies of scale aren't quite as big as the federal government, that they have an important role in showing how that, how we can, how these economic challenges can be faced. He was very articulate. He looked good. He was very well received, I thought, and he was good, very good.
Yes, doing well. We'll probably get him maybe future invites because I know they alluded to his first time acting like there would be more. Tim, your thoughts?
Yeah, I watched it too. All the things that Catherine said, pretty much. I believe this guy has the potential to be a Democratic superstar. Not only the next one in Georgia, which is at the moment kind of devoid of Democratic superstars, so he could easily step into the vacuum there. But I think on a national level, this guy's really coming to prominence in a hurry, and it's simply because he is doing such a great job in his job as mayor. And I'm just delighted with his progress so far, David.
Yes, so it'll be interesting to see what kind of opportunities that affords the mayor at times. I mean, obviously Sunday morning's probably okay time to be on there, but of course he's got the business of Atlanta most times during the week, of course. Well, I guess kind of following up on some stories from last week, we discussed in depth before the Super Bowl about Georgia lobbyists and how they were getting very cozy with the Republican leadership. We had the one link between David Ralston's son and the lobbying firm. And we had no idea that was just scratching the surface, if you will. Apparently, Clint Wilder, who gained a little fame during the campaign for having the failed business idea of an outdoor store within a few miles of the Bass Pro Shop, apparently he must be better, at least the Georgia healthcare lobby thinks, at lobbying for healthcare legislation or legislation to protect their interest. And they have hired him to be a lobbyist, and apparently there's no conflict of interest there, because I'm sure his father-in-law, who went into big-time debt and, you know, in other years and circumstances could have lost his political race over that scandal. There's, you know, no problems there. Tim, I heard you chuckle. What do you think of this?
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. This is the same Clint Wilder who has twice bankrupted. Now, he'll be going to work, I'm sure, at a healthy salary for the Georgia Healthcare Association. Now, look, the state does $1 billion worth of business with them in the nursing home industry every year. He doesn't have to really do anything except be who he is. Yeah, no conflict of interest there. And should we also mention the young lady who went to work for the same outfit, David?
Oh, well, we'll get to that. We got to take it a little bit of time. We got to stretch this thing out. Catherine, what do you think? You think they're going to give Clint Wilder his own personal expense account since he seems to be so good with money?
Oh, that's evil.
Well, I thought another interesting thing came up this week that, you know, some of these guys that are lobbyists, they just call themselves consultants, so then they don't have to do the same disclosures. So, I don't know. It seems like
yes.
A good job.
Oh, I mean, look, it's who he is. That's all that matters. He's not going to have to do anything. They probably don't want him to do anything except
go to dinner at his
remind his
father-in-law
over dinner what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good job if you married into it or were born into it, like the next situation. Apparently, David Ralston has more than one child, so therefore there's more than one lobbyist
ready to hire the Ralston children. Tim, what's the lobbying firm and which
one,
child is
this? This one, I believe, is a niece, is it not? Yeah.
Oh,
Sarah Ralston. Okay. Yeah, she goes to work for the same bunch. Oh, come on. At least they could pretend better than this, right?
I mean, the House Speaker's niece, the governor's son-in-law, going to work for $1 billion a year industry, or at least that does that kind of business with the state of Georgia. I mean, Ray Charles could see what's happening here, right?
It's my understanding that Casey Cagle, his kids are kind of young, but if their allowance is not enough, I know where they can boost that thing up. It's beyond believable. Yeah, it's, actually, and I tell you a strange thing. There it is. It's the bottom. I'm trying to find exactly how old his children were to see, because I've seen pictures and they do, like, they're under 18. But, you know, I mean, hey, as long as they have access to dad, I mean, I'm trying to think of other people that may want to get in on this, because it seems like, you know, get in while the getting's good.
Yeah, why stop at nieces and son-in-laws? Let's go with wives while we're at it, you know?
Yeah, I tell you what, Tim Catherine, if you're ever out of a job, go into Ancestry.com and see if you're related to anybody in the Republican leadership in Georgia, and, you know, you may have a job pretty quick. A little plug for Ancestry.com, I guess, there. What's that show? Who do you think you are? Who do they think they are with this stuff? And it just keeps going on. And then there becomes a debate among Republicans, I noticed, that, is this ethical or not? And they had a lot of defenders, but I thought Chris Huttman on Peach Pundit made a pretty good point. If, Clint Wilder knew so much about health care, why was he trying to run an outdoor store? You know, why wasn't he doing what he was good at from the get-go? And I thought it was an excellent point.
How is it that the speaker's niece got to be an expert on it all of a sudden, by the way?
Well,
I guess
an expert on...
Yeah, sure. I'm sure
whatever
it has nothing to
for.
Do with who she's kin to. Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy. And I don't know if y'all heard, I was hearing a little bit of something about this. They're talking about making newspaper reporters register as lobbyists because, of course, they have their own interest in trying to publish their newspaper.
Good grief.
And I thought, well, so they're throwing all these lobbyists in, and then they're trying to make it harder for the press to cover the thing. And there's not been much said about this, but because apparently they backed off before the session started, because had they, obviously, the lobbying industry would have jumped on that pretty heavily. I'd like to find out more and get us some more talk. But let's go ahead and move over to the East one state. Cross the Savannah River and talk to Jen Reed of the Indigo Journal. Welcome, Jen.
Hey, gang. How are y'all?
Good evening.
Oh, good to have you on.
Good. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Well, I know we know that you're going to bring up things we hadn't even thought about in the Palmetto State, but one thing that did get our attention and got the nation's attention was that y'all have a special house race. Now, usually that wouldn't catch a lot of attention, but Alvin Green decided to run for this. Jen, tell us how that's being received, and then, of course, take the liberty to tell us about other candidates that aren't quite as notorious as Mr. Green.
Sure, yeah. Well, like you said, Alvin Green is back on the scene. He entered to vie for this District 64 seat, which is up in Clarendon County. Which has been vacated by the death of Kathy Harvin back in December. And it was Christmas Eve, Alvin Green jumped into this race, creating quite a national buzz, obviously, after his recent loss to Jim DeMint in the Senate race. He's facing three other Democrats in a primary challenge that's scheduled for this Tuesday, I believe. It's February 15th. So it's garnered quite a bit of national attention, and the winner of this primary contest, the Democrat primary on Tuesday, will face one of two possible Republicans. Um, But in my opinion, I think this may be the end of the road for Alvin Green. The three gentlemen that he's up against, he's actually up against one gentleman, Kevin Johnson, who's the mayor of Manning, South Carolina, which is Alvin Green's hometown. Very prominent black politician. He's also, I believe, he's the president of the South Carolina State Municipal Association. So a very powerful gentleman, very well known, very well respected in those parts. If I was a betting woman, I'd put my money on Kevin Johnson at this point. There's also another gentleman named Dwight Stewart, who's chair of the Clarendon County Council. So I think if I was going to read any tea leaves, I would think that the vote Tuesday night in the Dem primary is probably going to come down to Kevin Johnson and or Dwight Stewart. So, I have a feeling that this will probably be the end of the line for Alvin Green, at least for the near future, if I had to guess. But
well, I tell you what, then you've helped me there, Jen. I'm going to go ahead and get the Alvin Green U.S. Senate candidate doll, not to say House candidate doll, because he apparently is not going to do as well as he did in that race.
No, I don't think so.
You told us about the Democratic side. How does the Republican side look from what you know?
From what I know, I have to be honest with you, I don't know a lot about the two gentlemen that are running. I know that this is historically a Democratic seat. Kathy Harvin, who, of course, passed away, is a longtime Democrat. There is some talk in Republican circles that because this is kind of shaping up to be a black versus white competition on the Democratic side between Kevin Johnson and Dwight Stewart, the white Democrat, some Republicans in South Carolina see a chance to potentially capitalize on this with one of their Republican candidates if there's a fracture in the Dem base. But I would say that's pretty wishful thinking. I mean, this is a pretty strong Dem stronghold. So I think we're going to see whoever wins the Democratic primary on Tuesday is most likely going to be the next rep for that region.
Yes, and any runoffs here, or is it plurality wins the primary?
You have to get 50% or more of the vote to lock it up, and because there are four candidates, there's probably going to be a runoff. Like I said, if I was a betting woman, I would see Kevin Johnson and Dwight Stewart facing off in a runoff a week later if there is one. So that would be my guess, because it's going to be hard for somebody to win 50% with four candidates in the field.
Yes, well, we'll have to see what happens there, and I know the actual final then race will happen April 5th. Well, you mentioned Jim DeMint, of course, being the person that defeated Alvin Green. Jim DeMint made a name for himself in 2010 by getting involved in seemingly every GOP U.S. Senate primary, and a lot of times against establishment candidate and for the Tea Party candidate, and apparently he's kind of doing that again. He's kind of made some moves in the Virginia Senate race. What kind of a feedback or pushback is he getting both in the state and out of the state in Republican circles by doing this?
In the state, I would say he enjoys a great deal of the Libertarian Club for Growth kind of support. The same Club for Growth has teamed up with him for his Senate Conservatives Fund. So I think here in South Carolina, it kind of falls along the GOP civil war lines we've seen for the last decade since the Bush-McCain presidential bid. You have the Libertarian, the fiscal conservatives that are kind of lined up behind Jim DeMint, and then you have the more social conservatives, some would even say moderate conservatives, who are lined up against, behind Lindsey Graham. And so I think you're seeing the same kind of split along those ideological lines on this matter across the state. I will say Jim DeMint here, as everywhere else, is a very polarizing figure. You either love him or you don't. And so I think he's got a great deal of support from the Tea Party kind of element of the party, the Libertarian element, in helping take on the so-called rhinos in these other Senate races across the country. But yeah, I guess it depends on which side of that ideological line you fall on if you're a Republican here in South Carolina.
Yes, well, of course, I can continue to ask you questions, but we have more hosts on here to ask.
things. Tim, what are some questions you have for Jennifer about South Carolina politics?
Yeah, well, first of all, Jennifer, I do want to make a comment. I'll make you a quick deal. I'll gladly give you $1 right now if you tell me with authority that space aliens have landed over there and they're going to kidnap Alvin Green. Okay? I mean, just right off the bat. I'll tell you who I want to ask you about, because you just mentioned him, and that's Lindsey Graham. We hear a lot about him being on kind of shaky ground over there.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that really stand for Lindsey Graham in that state right now?
I think for Lindsey Graham, his greatest challenge in the next election, assuming that he runs again in, I believe it's 2014, is always going to be from his right flank. He is not very well received by the hardcore elements of the base. So his greatest challenge will be surviving a potential primary challenge in a U.S. Senate race. There's a lot of talk right now about Senator Tom Davis, the state senator from my neck of the woods down here in Beaufort County. He is a what we call a Sanfordite. He's a Mark Sanford protege, former chief of staff to the governor, of that libertarian kind of Tea Party element of the party. His consultants, his gurus, have been trying to chat him up as a potential challenger to Lindsey Graham in 2014. He's a very well-funded gentleman. He's a real estate attorney down here. If I was, again, reading the tea leaves, I think the greatest threat to Lindsey Graham moving forward is going to be in a primary challenge. If he secures the primary nomination, he's actually pretty well regarded by independents and even Democrats such as myself as a guy that he's one of those people that you can talk to and you feel like he's always fair or at least more of a statesman, you know, that you can deal
mm-hmm.
with him. So he, for example, in the last election, he took 2/3 of the vote in the general. So his greatest challenge is always going to be from his right flank. But if he can survive that in a general election, he's tough to beat because he is pretty well regarded on both sides of the aisle.
Well, based then on the obvious strength of that right flank in South Carolina, would it be mm-hmm. fair to say that right now Jim DeMint is probably the most powerful political person in that state?
I would say on the Republican side, I guess it depends on what you mean by powerful. In terms of his pull and his clout in the Senate, I would say Lindsey Graham's far more influential because he's able to work well with other people, you know, to get earmarks, to get things passed. But in terms of fundraising and that kind of ideological, the guy you want campaigning with you if you're in a GOP primary, I think he is the most powerful in that kind of respect, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, it makes a lot of sense as a broadcaster. Thank you. Catherine?
Hey, Jen, thanks so much for being on.
I just wanted
to ask you a little bit about Indigo Journal. I noticed that you're offline updating your site. So what's going on?
Well, basically, after the November election, we got routed pretty good here. South Carolina Democrats did. And my partner and I decided
we know about that. We know that feeling here in Georgia.
Yeah, we needed a couple weeks break to, you know, recoup and regroup and recharge our batteries. We've been blogging for 3 years straight without a break, and so we decided that we were going to take a couple weeks off when it's slow before the 2012 season starts to, you know, gear back up. And actually, it's been a great opportunity because for about a year now, we've been wanting to redo the site and put a more activist function towards it. Move it from just a news commentary site to a true community site where people can not only blog and share their own ideas, but join groups and really turn it into more of an activist fight to give SC Dems a home, if you will, to kind of fight back. So we're actually in beta testing right now to revamp the site and launch IJ 2.0, hopefully in the next few weeks. So we will be back, but we are on a little holiday for some much-needed R&R right now.
Well, I can certainly understand that as one who blogs at Bug for Democracy. And not only do we get tired, but we also struggle for topics sometimes. You know, we can only talk about how bad the Democrats are for how so much we're struggling so much before you just get too depressed to even think about it.
But we will be back. but yes, we're taking a little hard off.
I have confidence that you'll be back. How's the party doing in South Carolina?
It's a mess. The Democratic, I mean, that's the most honest assessment I can give you, is it's an absolute shambles. We are, Carol Fowler, who's the current Democratic chair, is stepping down at the end of this term. And in April, we will be electing a new chair. Phil Noble, who's a Charleston businessman and president of the SC New Dems, a reform group out of Charleston, is rumored to be interested in the chair position. And I think this will be a really good opportunity for the activists, people like myself, and some of the Obama alumni to hopefully a new generation to come up and take the reins and start, you know, heading us in a new direction where we actually win something every now and then. So that's the hope, at least at this point.
Well, you know, we just had new leadership elections here in Georgia and mm-hmm. elected a full new slate of on our executive committee. And I think I don't like to say this because it's always, you know, a bad omen, but I feel like we have nowhere to go but up. So,
exactly.
I think I don't like to say it though. You know, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Forget Paris, but there's that line, you know, piece of cake. Like, I can't even say that phrase after seeing that movie. Anyway, I agree with you. It's a great opportunity with, you know, almost a year before we have to start really ramping up for 2012. I think mm-hmm. there's, you know, a lot of opportunities for changing things up a little bit, and I hope that you are successful and that we are as well, and that we bring the – because, you know, just this week they were talking about how the Democrats need to just write off the South. So
yeah,
that's
true.
We have to fight back against that message, right? Well,
exactly.
We're looking forward to the new site when it comes up, and maybe you can come back on and tell us about it once it launches.
Great. I'm looking forward to it.
David, back to you.
Yeah, and then, of course, people can still find you on the Facebook group y'all have. So, like,
mm-hmm.
if you posted about you being on, people would then flock to hear you, and that's a good deal. Because I know y'all's group is pretty large and active.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we're also on Twitter. You can find us on Twitter at Indigo Journal. And we're on that quite a bit.
Oh, awesome.
Yes. And don't worry, we got more topics because South Carolina's an exciting place. Jen, you're what you sent me back on some things happening. You know, I had checked my wallets, how much money I had, and I thought, well, I need a backup. So I better check my board games and see what kind of backup after Senator Lee. Let me get Lee's name right. Senator Lee Bright. Yeah, he's shined the light on this problem. Apparently,
uh-huh.
he says that South Carolina should coin its own money. I guess he's a big Articles of Confederation fan. What can you tell us about Senator Bright's proposal?
Yes, our most ironically named senator, Senator Lee Bright from the upstate. He's a big states' rights activist. He's the guy who every year sponsors new states' rights legislation. He actually tried this trick back in last year, it was. And when it failed to pass, I think members of his own party shot this down last year, his idea for South Carolina to print our own funding. When that was shot down last year, his comment was, if at first you don't secede, try again. So I guess he's at it again.
I love that line. I love that line.
Only problem is John C. Calhoun beat him to the punch over 120 years ago.
Yes, Senator Bright is always on a mission to prove that it's always 1862 somewhere here in South Carolina. So, he has proposed that he has proposed legislation this week to introduce basically he wants an 8-member subcommittee to study this proposal to print our own currency in the event that the Fed goes belly up at some point and report back on those findings on November 1. And, you know, of course, those of us who are looking at a $750 million budget deficit, Medicaid's bankrupt, and we have, I think we're still in the top 5 in unemployment in the country, are wondering why we're spending time on, you know, currency for South Carolina when we have all these other issues. So if for no other reason than financial concerns, we don't have the money to fund the subcommittee. I don't think this is going anywhere, but it's yet another topic, I guess, for the late night pundits to poke fun at South Carolina about. So yeah, never
well,
dull here.
He's got a he's got a friend in Georgia, because we got a fellow in our state that is trying to really increase our college enrollment by doing away with the need for fake IDs. Because he just wants to get rid of all driver's licenses in general. So South Carolina money and no driver's licenses if you went back and forth from Augusta to Aiken, having some fun there along the borders, I guess Hartwell and, you know, Clemson and all those kind of things. Well, there's still more. There's actually some good news for South Carolina. South Carolina has grown so much that y'all are actually adding a congressional district, while other states in the South, like Louisiana and I guess Mississippi, didn't lose any more this time, but they're not gaining seats, but y'all are. Where do you predict this seat will be? Do you predict it'll change the how many Democrats and Republicans? What do you see for it?
Yeah, the current projections have the new 7th district landing somewhere along the coast. Currently, the 1st district, which is represented by the newly elected Tim Scott, a Republican African-American, seated in Charleston, stretches all the way from Charleston up to the state line, up to North Carolina. And so it's a massive district, so we're looking for that one to probably be split in two. Keep in mind that here in South Carolina, we have a state house, and the governor's office is GOP-dominated. So it's going to be interesting how they work together with the Justice Department to draw up the new lines. The South Carolina Republicans would like this new district to be seated in the Myrtle Beach area, up in the northeast quadrant of the state. It's a strong Republican area, and so the thinking is that the new district will be Myrtle Beach will be the seat of the new district up in the northeast quadrant, and the first district will probably be lumped in with the southern county, Beaufort County, which is also a GOP stronghold, to try and offset some of the Dem gains in Charleston over the last couple of years. I'm thinking the other thing they're going to try and do is shore up Mick Mulvaney up in the 5th district. He, of course, knocked off John Spratt, longtime Democrat rep, in November. And if I was guessing, I would say they're probably going to take some of those Dem-leaning counties that make it such a swing district and stick those into the new district, along with Horry County in the Myrtle Beach area, to make the Republican seat there stronger. They're probably going to also try and shore up Joe Wilson in the 2nd district by making his district a little bit brighter red. He struggled, of course, in 2008 against Democrat Rob Miller, surviving a challenge from him by single digits, and then again struggled this past year despite overwhelming gains nationwide by Republicans. He also struggled. So I would look for a new seat probably located up in the Myrtle Beach area, and for Republicans here to focus on shoring up Mick Mulvaney and Joe Wilson. If I was guessing, that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a pretty well-thought-out analysis there. Well, you had also brought another issue to us. Andre Bauer, who was controversial in his own right, he's been succeeded, we had succession earlier in the show, by probably a guy that's gotten more controversial faster than Lieutenant Governor Bauer. Tell us about that.
Yes, Ken Ard, our new Republican Lieutenant Governor, less than a month into his first term, is already facing an ethics inquiry for apparently the State Ethics Commission has found that he's spent more than close to $25,000 in campaign funds since winning the election on November 2. Under SC state law, you're only supposed to spend your campaign funds on campaign-related expenses that are occurred.
Imagine
during
that.
A specific race. Yeah. And so it was, the Columbia Free Times, which is a great alternative weekly up in Columbia, they publish about once a week, did an analysis and found that he has spent close to $25,000 since November 2 on everything from hotel rooms during the SEC championship in Atlanta over near y'all. He spent $3,000 at a Best Buy computer store. He dropped another $800 in campaign funds on a women's clothing store in Florence. I mean, just all kinds of wild expenditures that, you know, have raised a few red flags here. So his response to this, you know, questioning about how he's spending his money was that he's just not real good at dotting his I's and crossing his T's. And, yeah, that's not going over real well with the Ethics Commission right now. So they've given him till February 25th to try and explain the spending. And he has, after a rough week with the press, he has quit talking to the media. His spokeswoman is no longer returning phone calls, and he has retained counsel to help him with this. So it's an interesting first 3 weeks for our new lieutenant governor, Ken Arg.
But isn't
yeah,
that
I mean, Sarah Palin made news when she spent all that money on women's clothing, but at least she had the excuse that she could wear it in public. I wonder what his excuse will be.
Just tell me these clothes are not for him. Just tell me that much, please.
Well, one would hope. I will say if your listeners are in need of comic entertainment tonight, somebody has created an account on Twitter called Ken Ard's Dress, which I highly recommend.
Oh, no.
If you would like to follow the latest in the scandal. his little red dress likes to chime in on Twitter now. So, yes, lots of people are having fun with this. And so he's got till February 25th, and he and his lawyer, I guess, are putting together a report for the Ethics Commission to update them on why he's spending this money the way he is. So that should be
fun. But now,
well,
isn't his attorney the same attorney that Mark Sanford had? Isn't that what I read?
I believe so. Butch Bowers is his attorney. He's a very prominent Republican attorney based out of Columbia. He represents most of the big GOP politicians whenever they get into trouble. and he's very good. He's very sharp, and he was playing this off as though it was just a pretty rudimentary, you know, this happens all the time, you know, trying to play it off to the media. So it'll be interesting to see what they say, you know.
Jennifer, I mean, the Ethics Commission is probably packed full of Republicans. So how big a problem is this really for the lieutenant governor?
I would say Kennard's got two things going for him. One is that the fines, usually the fines with the Ethics Committee are not that bad. He actually has been in trouble before with them for reporting problems. He was originally fined, I think it was in the last 3 years, for failing to disclose certain campaign reports, $43,000. And he had that argued down to a $1,000 fine. So the fact that, you know, he's proven that he can talk himself out of a lot of things. He's looking at most likely fines for this rather than, you know, any kind of impeachment charges. The other thing he's got going for him is that here in South Carolina, the lieutenant governor's position is largely a ceremonial position.
Mm-hmm.
He presides over the Senate. During Andre Bauer's administration, they gave him the administration, the Office on Aging, to kind of let him have something to look over. But for the most part, it's a very ceremonial position. So I think this would probably be a bigger deal if it was, say, the state treasurer or the attorney general. But you know, this is definitely not a good way to start your first term.
Yeah, obviously.
It's certainly a black eye for the state Republican Party. But I don't think he's going to leave as a result of this. But yeah, not a great way to start.
Okay.
Yes. Well, Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Anything else we need to know about the Palmetto State before I let you get out of here?
Just real quick, 2012, the Republican presidential race is starting to heat up. This week, Michelle Bachmann, Tea Party favorite, is going to be in town on the 19th, talking to the Columbia Women's Republican something or another. So I would look for more people like that to start popping up in the next coming weeks.
Yes, well, we'll be following you on Facebook, and until you get the new site up, we'll be looking forward to seeing the new Indigo Journal in the coming weeks.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for having me, y'all.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yes. Well, that was Jennifer Reed filling us like only she can on South Carolina politics. And now it's time to move around to some other states. But first, Tim, we had mentioned a little South Carolina redistricting, and you had a little bit of an outrage on redistricting from another state, I guess. Go ahead and go with your outrage, Tim.
As luck would have it, I do, so let's let the games begin. There's an old political saying which originated with Democratic Senator William L. Marcy over 150 years ago. Now, it says, in politics, to the victor goes the spoils. The modern-day Georgia Republicans are carrying that process to new levels. It was recently announced that the state legislature would create a new legislative and congressional reapportionment office, and further, the nonpartisan Carl Vinson Institute of Government, which had a state contract to redraw districts in the past, would no longer be doing so. So let me get this straight. The same Republicans who whined 10 years ago about how awful the Democrats were doing them on this very same issue are now doing the same thing and even more. But when the Democrats did it, oh, it was just terrible and a slap in the face of Georgia voters. But not now, folks. Oh, no, this is different. But listen, folks, what's different is that yesterday's canary is now today's hungry cat, and a different bunch is getting their ox gored. I know the Democrats didn't do the right thing 10 years ago. It was a blooming mess. But that's the reason the Republicans give for making this right, revenge? What about good government? Where does that fit in here? Whatever happened to we're going to be different? The only thing different is that this is even worse. And let me get something else straight. You fiscal conservatives out there talk about cutting funding for pre-K and cutting out some benefits of the Hope Scholarship. You make noise about taking even more from practically bankrupt public schools in order to give tax breaks to the wealthy parents of kids who attend private schools. You advocate new sales taxes and service taxes that hurt our poorest citizens in the name of balancing the budget. You brush off problems of water, transportation, and infrastructure decay because you say we must all sacrifice and pay our way. And now you tell me with a straight face that you wish to create a new bureaucracy financed with my tax money that will do nothing more than get rid of the people that I vote for? And Ann Lewis, the counsel to the Georgia GOP, will advise them on how to do that also on my dime? And I'm supposed to swallow that? Look. It's not really news that the Republicans would want to take this opportunity to annihilate the Democratic Party in Georgia. I'm not a Pollyanna. I know what this right-wing teabagger kissing bunch is trying to do. What gets me is that the voters apparently either don't care, don't know, or they approve. I haven't really heard that much about this, and believe me, this is a big deal. This one thing could permanently install the Republicans as essentially the only major political party in this state. No other voice would be heard. No opposition would be there in the foreseeable future. One side would get every last thing they desired with no check, with no balance. There have been a few Democrats in the legislature, such as Horacina Tate, who had voice their displeasure with this new system. But they are just a few voices crying in the wilderness, and their ideas for something more equitable had been dismissed by the majority party. And Dr. Tate, if you are listening, thank you for standing up for people like me. I wish there were more in there like you. So here's what's going to happen. The Republicans will get their way and hijack the process since they have ironclad control of the state government. The new 14th congressional district will likely be placed northeast of Atlanta because the governor, lieutenant governor, and House Speaker all come from that area. Congressman Barrows and Bishop will definitely be targeted for elimination. The three remaining congressmen in the Atlanta area will be safe. The Republicans can't do anything about them, at least not yet. In the legislature, at least two Senate seats and at least six House seats will move from the south to the north, reflecting North Metro growth, and more importantly, reflecting where the leadership lives. Not only will Georgia Democrats not sit at the table, but neither will the people of South Georgia. And those few remaining rural Democrats will also be targeted, offered the choice of switching parties or having their districts carved up. Realistically, the genuine losers in this type of process are all the people of Georgia. 10 years ago, similar behavior by the other party was greeted with outrage. Well, where's the outrage now? Where are those who scream about weirdly drawn snake-like districts and unfair gerrymandering for the sake of rabid partisanship? Because that's what's about to happen now. You folks listening to me tonight, is this what you want? No choice? You just want to sit and watch it happen? Could some of you actually approve of this cheap brand of fascism? And yes, I said fascism, for it is nothing more than a naked power grab and a move toward dictatorial control. The Republicans are doing this because they can. They preach the virtues of bipartisanship in a two-party system, and they don't believe a word of that. Or their idea of bipartisanship is that they must get their way about everything. And the outrage, well, obviously, that duty now rests with a few folks like me talking to a few folks like you in a shrinking number of outlets like this. And to those few faithful elected Democratic friends in outlying areas, I say thank you for keeping that faith. And pack your bags, because move-in day is coming. I close these thoughts tonight with this great irony. Tomorrow's map will be drawn by yesterday's Democrats, who are now today's Republicans. A dizzying prospect indeed. And this coming summer, a sobering reality, David. David?
Uh-oh, what happened to David?
I guess that's what Republicans want to keep it. Not a lot of talk about it. So they can have it, you know, done in their state party offices.
It's
is what
coming,
I predict.
Though. It's coming,
yeah.
And it ain't going to be pretty.
Well, we've got about 14 minutes and four more topics, and some of them are kind of long discussions. But one, Tim, I just wanted to go ahead and give you kudos on something you called out, even though it's really kind of bad news for Virginia Democrats. You know, we were talking about George Allen getting back in that race to defeat Jim Webb, who defeated him back 5 years ago, and you had kind of warned us that Jim Webb was not raising money like he should have, and there were maybe some rumors that he wouldn't run, and sure enough, you know, 3-4 days later, it comes out that he would not run. So, Tim, you were big time up on that one. So, Tim, we got to come to you again. Who's going to run if Jim Webb won't?
Boy, is that the $20 million question. There's talk about Kane running.
Oh, really?
Just talk about it now, you know, in the absence of anybody else. He would be the obvious choice. Perhaps one of the losers in the primary in the last Senate race, with like Terry McAuliffe, for instance, might take a look at it again. But this, I don't think this really surprised a lot of people, because all you got to do in these things is follow the money, or in this case, the lack of it. And he wasn't out there raising it. And that generally sends off the signal that, hey, something is up. So I think there's been something going on behind the scenes that we haven't heard as far as a big person jumping into that race, because that's a very winnable race in an election year against a guy that has shown he has a penchant for blowing such races. Not only that, he's not going to get a free ride. If you guys have been reading, looks like the Tea Party folks are going to go after Senator Allen.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, what have you been hearing, and what are your thoughts on this Virginia race?
Well, I was surprised to hear it. I mean, not after Tim had mentioned it, but it's still, you know, it's a disappointment. I haven't heard anything about anyone running. I don't know that they, I mean, it seems like it would be hard for Tim Kaine to run. Well, maybe that's why he's been so, what's the nice way to say it? Tame, I guess, as DNC chair, and because he was hoping to, you know, pursue additional political activities. I hope Terry McAuliffe doesn't win because I don't think he's got a chance.
Well, Terry McAuliffe could raise the money. That's the upside, because I heard a figure reported that it'll be a $25 million race for each candidate, they're thinking. Very expensive race. So that's the upside. I mean, obviously, Terry McAuliffe has a baggage that he has to race 30, but
the downside is there, too. And you recall the cries of interloper and such as that. Can McAuliffe overcome that sort of thing?
I don't think he can.
I don't know. I don't know that he's the perfect candidate, but this isn't a few years ago when Mark Warner was running, for his seat, and it was just the Republicans were like, what do we do? And, you know, George Allen is not, you know, he's a little bit damaged goods. And so it's definitely not a race that you would want to take and bet your mortgage payment either way if you had, you know, a solid Democratic candidate. I did read where Jerry Connolly was telling folks that he would be a viable candidate. And viable is not this adjective that really inspires, you know, people to rally the troops and, of course, open the coffers up either. So, it looks like we've got a little work to do recruiting there, and that's not the only state like that.
That's true.
Yeah. Let's go ahead. And since I'm talking about recruiting woes, I want to get this presidential discussion because that was fascinating. I don't know if the viewers out there watch the Chris Matthews weekend program, not the Hardball that comes on during the week, but the syndicated program that usually comes on NBC Saturday night, Sunday morning, sometime in there. I think it's one of the better national programs because it's very, you know, political. It's very horse race. It's kind of what I enjoy. So if you like that kind of thing, like I do, I highly recommend it. But they had John Heilman, who writes for the New York Times, wrote Game Change. I mean, a guy that I think is pretty much in the know on things. And he had a few things. He actually thinks there's still a good chance that Jeb Bush will get in the race. The National Review put Jeb Bush on the cover this week, basically begging and pleading him for him to get in. And he's still saying no. That was one interesting development out of that. The second one was John Heilman says that Haley Barbour is still running for president. We kind of talked about that being a little bit of a surprise based on some comments he had made recently and the fact that his wife is very apolitical. And then the third comment that really blew me away was that Mike Huckabee is not going to run. He is hearing that he may be making too much money working for Fox News and others, and maybe the speaker circuit, and he just can't, you know, afford to give that up, if you will. And so he won't run, and the White House actually thinks Mike Huckabee right now would be the nominee. Catherine, react in any way to all this I've told you.
Well, I can't, you know, Haley Barbour, really, I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I thought he was done.
I was intrigued by that comment about Mike Huckabee, because, I mean, it sure seems like people want him to run. You know, he gets a lot of, you know, in these straw polls and stuff, he gets a lot of support. I find it interesting that Mr. Populist, you know, I mean, that was always the tag that he was given, was that, well, he's the populist guy, you know, that he would choose not to run because he's making so much money. I mean, I think that's kind of at least in my mind, it seems like a contradictory situation. But I just can't imagine that Jeb Bush would run. I mean, after what he's watched his brother and his father, come away from that their presidency, you know, almost shells of their former selves, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, look at, I saw George W. Bush. I guess he was at some, was he at the Super Bowl? You know, I don't know. Sports,
yeah,
but
he was.
I think
George
he was
Bush was
Bowl.
At the Super Bowl. Yeah,
and he looked old. He looked tired, and you know, he really. I mean, I don't. You know, I never had any respect for the guy. Honestly, I mean, I have respect for the office, but I never had any respect for the person. And I think he's you know, really a shadow of his former self, it seems. Now his father has sort of over the years become a little bit more of a statesman, and you know, his work on behalf of charities has been you know, commendable, I guess. But I just can't imagine that Jeb would go in for that. I'm, but you know, I guess power is power, and if you want it, you're going to go after it if you think you can get it. But it just would surprise me.
Yeah, and it's National Review begging him, basically, on the cover of their magazine. Tim, your thoughts?
Interesting that they're begging somebody that's expressing no interest in this race to get in this race when at the same time all of them are claiming that, you know, a lamppost can beat the president right now for various reasons. Jeb Bush is not going to run. If he did, I don't think he could get the Republican nomination. We're not in a time anymore where you can, like, storm the gates and jump in the race at the last minute. We're in an age now of guys and gals running for 3 years and having to spend $1 billion to do it and picking up the most professional staff that they probably possibly can and getting all these volunteer organizations in even the smallest states, because even the smallest states have delegates that could get you elected. And also, Catherine said it, the Bush name right now I think is poisonous in Republican circles. I don't think they'd ever give him the nomination. Now, Huckabee, yeah, I don't guess anybody knows. He has said that he will not decide until the summertime whether or not he's even going to run. But, I mean, if he stays at the top or near the top of all these polls, which he's presently doing, how can he ignore that, David or Catherine?
Yeah.
I mean, how could he ignore that?
Yeah, I want to respond to both things. One, you know, Jeb Bush, fair or not fair, he will have to run more on his brother's record than any other Republican would. And that would allow the president to actually run parts of the 2008 campaign again. And
right.
So, and some of those themes. And no other Republican affords him that luxury. And it would be a luxury, because then he could say, hey, this is what I inherited. It would remind people of that. And like I said, and I think if you looked at George Sr., George W. Jr., and Jeb, Jeb's probably the sharpest tack of the three. I mean,
I think so. I absolutely think
but
so.
But, and you could, and he definitely has the fact that Florida would become a much tougher state for the president to win. Also, the fact that he has more ties to the Latino community, he might do better than with among Hispanics than almost any other Republican candidate that we know seriously is looking at running would do. So he has some upside, but that downside then, it might make the president easier to have victories in places like Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania,
but
if he lost Florida.
But before any of that happens, how's Jeb Bush going to get through that gauntlet of primaries and caucuses against those social conservatives and stuff like that? How's he going to do that?
Well, he would have to do this. If there's enough of them, you know, Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, they both fish out of the same pool. I don't know that anybody feels real strongly about Mitt Romney. You know, I don't think it's this – I don't think it's formidable as it seems because, you know, John McCain, who was not real popular among the social conservatives, he threaded the needle 4 years ago. Now, you can say that they're a more developed bunch now. But, I mean, there's things there. And as far as Mike Huckabee goes, while he would have to take a hiatus on the speaking and different things while he ran, should he lose, he could go back, right back on the same tour, and if he did pretty well, might make more than he did before. So I don't know why that would preclude him. I'm thinking he probably knows how to save money a little better than Clint Wilder, speaking of other Republicans we've spoken about on the show. So, I mean, you know, and I don't know that he's a caviar lifestyle anyway, so I don't know. But it's interesting that the lead political reporter for the New York Times and the White House operatives are disagreeing on something that fundamental and how they're reading the thing. So I found that intriguing. Well, guys, I thought this was a great show. I want to thank Jen Reed again for coming on to the, talk about South Carolina politics. And Jim and Catherine, thanks for this great discussion tonight on the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, and thank you.
Good night.
Good evening.
We are the heirs of that first.